open the...
We're leaving, we're taxiing out to the runway in Scappoose, and they're crawling.
Open the, thank you, House Committee on Business and Labor, and open a public hearing on House Bill 469, or excuse me, Senate Bill 469.
Mr. Chair, Committee Member, Senate Bill 469 exempts individuals 16 years of age and younger from obtaining a business license if the individual operates as a sole proprietor under their own name. The measure passed unanimously out of the Senate Business and Transportation Committee and the Senate floor.
Senator, you want to come on up here? Tell us what we're doing.
Mr. Chair, this is exactly what I need to get my business off the ground.
Okay. he's just preempted us.
Verification provided for in this bill.
Good morning, members. For the record, I'm Jason Atkinson. I represent Senate District 2, a good portion of Southern Oregon. And I have to tell you, I'm a little bit nervous to see so many people. There's as much as you on this one committee as there is in half the Senate. There's a lot of suits. I kind of wish Thatcher were here to balance things out with Teresa just a little bit. The portion of the bill, colleagues, it's very odd that this bill would have gained national attention. Certainly was not my intent. I was giving a speech in Eugene one time, and someone who was there said, hey, I just read about this bill in USA Today, which scared me a little bit because I didn't really have any context of why it would be there. But this bill actually was brought to me by some folks, and upon further discussion, found that this is a bit of an issue with kids who are doing such exotic entrepreneurial work, such as babysitting, lemonade stands, and car washes for youth groups, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so what the bill simply does is simply says is that you don't need a business license to engage in that kind of activity. And with that, I'd be delighted to ask all of you or answer any questions that you all might have.
Senator, the only and I agree, I mean, when I was a kid, I worked, did a lot of business, mowing lawns, cleaning gutters, whatever came along. And I just knocked on my neighbor's door and asked him if I could work for him.
Me too.
Yeah, no. The only question that's come up is we're exempting kids under a certain, above and below a certain age from getting a business license if they're the sole proprietor. Can they buy GM and run that business without a business license? So where's the threshold here? Okay.
Could you restate?
We're saying
I'm only a half a cup of coffee.
That's okay. You're doing great.
Yeah.
Where can it, what's the limitation for a child of a young person of 17, for example? Where do you draw the line on where they would need to get a business license?
Well, I guess anything above a sole proprietor. Sole proprietor, Oregon being unique in the sense that a sole proprietor, and we are one of few states where you can have a single member LLC. Basically, what we're saying is in those typical activities that a kid might engage in and go out and try to earn a buck, whether it be as innocent as a lemonade stand or as entrepreneurial as one of my gigs, which was door-to-door car washing, which is highly lucrative. I probably pays more than being in the Senate. But the bar is right there. It's at that few times a week sole proprietorship, kid making a buck. Not an S corp, not a partnership. You know, I mean, if the kid is the next Bill Gates or something like that, and whose father's an attorney and is going to go after making large amounts of money and probably sets up something so that the computers that they're making in the garage doesn't leverage and risk the entire household and sets up some kind of an LLC or some kind of risk advertisement or protection, I would say that they wouldn't fit into this bill.
The reason my wife's a sole proprietor. I've had a business. I've never had any employees, but she has seven. So could the kid have a, and I'm not against this bill, I'm voting yes, but could the young person have employees in the whole ball of wax?
That's a good question.
Mr. Chair?
I'm just looking at the bill, and it says it excludes things that require a license or certification. So
I read that, too.
Authorization to conduct. So I would think Department of Revenue requires me to file tax returns for employees and things, so they wouldn't be exempt for those type. This is, that's where it would start to fall, where, well, there's the line that has to be drawn.
Yeah, that's the answer I was looking for right there.
Thank you very much, Chair and Vice Chair. You can take this to any various levels, but did Tom Sawyer get Huck Finn pay payroll taxes when he talked him into painting the fence? As a budding entrepreneur, I would hope not.
All right.
I guess the legal definition he should have.
I beat you up enough on this one, but some people asked me to ask those questions, and that's
Thank
the answer
you.
I was looking for.
Thank you very
any
much.
Any questions of the good senator who's trying to get kids to learn that good, strong American work ethic that needs some help? All righty, then.
Thank you.
Thank you. Would anyone else like to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 469 today? Thank you, Senator. Seeing none, I'm going to close public hearing on Senate Bill 469, open work session on Senate Bill 469.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 469 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves Senate Bill 469 to the floor with due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion?
Mr. Senator. I may have to declare a conflict on this.
He's getting out in front of us, Senator. All right. Any other legitimate conversation, discussion, comments? Any opposition to the bill? Seeing none, so moved, and I'm going to take this to the floor and carry it myself, unless it merits the consent calendar.
I think we should talk about it.
All right. I think we should, too. We need to get kids working. That's all there is to it. All righty, then. Are we, is Senator Monroe here? Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 7.
Mr. Chair, Committee Members, SCR 7 congratulates William Paul Young for his success as author of The Chef.
Senator, good morning. My state senator.
Good morning. Gives me a great deal of pleasure to be here. I'm Rod Monroe, state senator in District 24. And we have a little resolution honoring Paul Young, who is a resident of Happy Valley, and who has written a little book called The Shack, which is now at about $7 million and has been on the...
7 million copies.
7 million copies. I'm sorry, not 7 million dollars.
Sorry about that.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Kinnear.
That'd be Representative Kinnear.
Well, I knew him when he was Senator Kinnear. And we served together previously a long time ago. Anyway, Paul Young has a bestseller. I have read it. It's a fascinating book. It's got some interesting theology in it that has shaken up a lot of people, which is a good thing. And since he is a resident of Happy Valley and of Oregon, and since this book likely will be made into a movie, which will be set in Oregon, because the book is set at Multnomah Falls and Wallowa Lake and the Wallowa Mountains and towns like Joseph and so on, and I can imagine that this will bring millions of dollars of economic development into our state. People all over the world are reading this book. It's been translated into, I think, 7 different languages, and people are all over the world. And so Paul Young was telling me he was here when the Senate passed this resolution unanimously a couple of weeks ago. He was my guest. And he was telling me that he keeps hearing from people, is there really a place called Multnomah Falls? Is there really a Wallowa Lake? And yes, there is. And so I just found it really exciting to read the book. It challenges anybody that studied theology or that has an interest in theology. It'll challenge your thinking, and that's a good thing. But I think it's appropriate that we honor this man. And so I was happy, along with your chair, to introduce this resolution and to shepherd it through the process. Be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. I'm going to have to borrow your copy and read it before the floor.
It's a fairly short
conversation
book.
Because I'm fascinated with theology from, you know, well, Erasmus Castillo to Bertrand Russell, you know, Thomas Paine. We've got all these folks out there that dabble in what's real and what isn't and what's made it all. And so I'd better read the book before, because I feel compelled and obligated, I think, to carry this on the floor. But any other questions? Any questions of the good senator? Seeing none, we're going to let you off the hook.
Thank you so much, and just go ahead and ship this puppy on out. And
can I borrow your copy of the book, though?
You can.
All right, good. All right, with that, anyone else want to testify on SCR 7 today? Seeing no one, I'll close public hearing on SCR 7 and open working session on SCR 7.
Mr. Chair, I move SCR 7 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves SCR 7 for due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, so moved. And I'll carry this one on the floor, too.
Two in a row today.
Pretty rare.
Heavy lifting, sir.
I try my best. That's right, Representative. Thank you for recognizing that. All righty then. What are we doing here? Is there, are we doing this in order?
No, okay.
I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 383.
Mr. Chair,
so great to be appreciated by my committee members.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 383 allows a home care worker who is a party in a contested case hearing conducted by the Department of Human Services to be represented by a labor union representative. The measure passed unanimously out of the Commerce and Workforce Development Committee and off the Senate floor with a 28-2 vote.
Megan Moyer with SEIU. Megan.
Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Megan Moyer. I'm with the Service Employee International Union, Local 503. And Senate Bill 383 comes to you as a result of a case that I've outlined, actually. It's testimony on behalf of Carla Spence, who's with our union. She was unable to attend today due to a family medical leave issue. But her testimony outlines the scenario that brings this bill before you today. We had a worker who was providing home care for several years for a client, and during the holiday season invited that client to, who had no family, to spend the holidays at her house. The Department of Human Services interpreted that decision, that she stayed for approximately 3 weeks, interpreted that situation as running an illegal adult foster home, and began the proceeding to terminate her provider number, which for a home care worker is the process for termination. We had, in collective bargaining and administrative rule, established a process in which the union could represent a home care worker, and there are many steps before, in a contested case hearing, before you go to administrative law judge, and we had represented her in those proceedings. But unfortunately, for the first time ever and the only time, we actually had a case that went to administrative law judge. At that time, our staff attorney was prepared to represent her, and literally, as we were headed into the hearing, were informed by the Department of Human Services after consultation with DOJ that the home care worker did not have the right to union representation in that hearing. Through some maneuvering and conversations, we were able to be present based on third-party interest, which was not the preferred way we'd want to do it, based off of our loss of dues. She was able to have the union representation. She was actually prevailed in that judgment, was reinstated as a home care worker, subsequently we helped her find her own legal counsel and sued because it was an over a year process in which point she had lost her home because she was unable to work. So this comes before you to fix what we did not know was an issue, was that even though we had language in our contract and in administrative rule, we did not have statutory authority for the union to represent workers through what is their termination process. One of the language of the bill allows for union representation, not just union lawyer representation, and that is consistent with other scenarios where someone may be in front of an administrative law judge, such as a Social Security hearing. Often a paralegal may be representing. We are not asking to serve as somebody's private attorney. They actually have that legal right to a private attorney. If they chose to hire that, that would still stand. This is specific to union representation, which is different than representing somebody as an individual. We will only represent them in their capacity as a union member and their rights as an employee in that unit.
Megan, so the worker had and could not be denied legal representation. They were denied union representation. Could they turn down under this scenario? I'm not really interested. I'm personally interested in the case, but legislatively, I'm not interested in the case. You see where I'm going with that? Can the worker deny union representation if necessary? And then in other scenarios, and you're nodding your head yes. When I ask a question, I'd appreciate if you talk into the phone so other people can hear what's going on. So in other union cases where there's an administrative law judge, are other union members both legally represented and have the option of union representation as well currently?
For the purposes of most of our members, they do not appear in front of an administrative law judge. The reason why they, in this process, the termination process, is in front of an administrative law judge is because although we bargain with the Home Care Commission, the sole Medicaid authority is the Department of Human Services, and because they are a Medicaid provider, that the authority to terminate a Medicaid provider must stay with the Department of Human Services, and therefore that process is separated from whom we're collectively bargaining with. If we were talking about an employee of the Department of Human Services or an employee of a different state agency, the process is different, and it does not go in front of an administrative law judge. So this is actually our care providers are our only workers whose termination process is in this setting.
And I'm going to vote yes on the bill. Don't get me wrong, but what is the benefit of having, you already have legal representation, no one can deny you that. What is the benefit of having union representation as well? Explain to me why we need to do this.
The reason this is needed is because home care workers make at a maximum $10.20 an hour. Many of them could not afford to retain an attorney. So often union representation may be their only opportunity for representation. They certainly would have the right to go and get their own personal attorney, but we also feel that we have an interest in these cases because we're not only helping that individual union member, but it's about precedent. It's about interpretation of the contract and interpretation of the rules governing the work that a worker does. So we believe we have an interest in this process because it is about more than that individual, and we would want to have a voice in arguing that argument because it would have precedent on other workers.
And just so I get this right, so I'm a worker without benefit of this legislation. I'm drugged before an administrative law judge. That court, if you will, does not have the mandate to provide me with legal representation. Is that correct?
Representative Shoffley, that is correct.
So I'm on my own before those judges.
Okay. That is correct.
Thank you. Bring it. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I do have some issues with the bill. And specifically, so essentially what this is it's the practice of a law. This bill authorizes the practice of law in certain narrow contexts, admittedly, by non-lawyers. Specifically, and you mentioned certain other contexts in which that might occur, for example, a Social Security hearing. But I don't know that actually that limited practice is the same. For example, here this bill specifically talks about arguing the admissibility of evidence, and there are some real problems here. Most notably, this is what if, and as is frankly quite likely, the non-lawyer who is doing the legal work commits malpractice because they're not a member of the bar. They don't have PLF insurance. The person would not be able to. It just seems to me fraught with peril.
Chair Schauffler, Representative Barton, to your question, there are, and you'll see under my testimony, there are actually multiple different settings where in an administrative law judge that non-lawyers represent people and provide evidence. And so this is, I'm not asking to create a new precedent. This is actually common practice for administrative law in many different areas. In regards to the liability, that's actually a separate issue. We're acting as the individual's personal attorney. And that is really important. This is not a bill that gives somebody, the union will act as their personal attorney. The union is acting as the union's attorney. And therefore, our liability is to the union. We do carry liability insurance, and our lawyers have that. But it is a very important distinction. When you are getting union representation, that is not equivalent to having individual representation. And what the scope of which we will argue and if we will take your case or not is an internal process where we evaluate if you have been grieved at, or we disagree with the ruling based on the status of your employment and as a union member. It is not about the whole scope of the things that you could be arguing about. It is very limited to your membership in the union, your rights as a worker, a represented worker. So,
follow up, Mr. Chair.
Before you do, I think the union should provide legal representation to these workers with a lawyer. Every person going, and that's my opinion. I know that costs money, and I'm familiar with the administrative law judges. I'm really good friends with one. I'm asking these questions, so I want people to know what's going on here. But I think they should have a lawyer, and that lawyer should be providing them with legal counsel. That's my opinion. Representative Barton.
I'm sympathetic to that as well, Mr. Chair. So I would, first of all, I appreciate your response. 2 points in response to that. Number one, granted, this might not be without, this might be common practice in other forms of administrative law. I would love to see if the statute is drafted exactly the same way. I suspect, actually, that the scope of practice, the scope of that exception we make, might be different from case to case, and I want to make sure that, to the extent that this is merely conforming, I'd love to make sure it's doing just that. But you said that, in this case, the union is not actually representing the client. It's representing the union's interest. But the case that produced this, you talked about, it was the third-party interest was not sufficient for you. And the DOJ already allowed them. The union can already have a third-party interest and already intervene as a third-party intervener. If the union's only representing the union's interest, then this bill isn't necessary. They already have the right to do so.
For Chair Schauffler, Representative Barton, the individual interest and the union interest are not separate. An individual is the union. I mean, you're saying it's third party. I would beg to disagree. But
to clarify,
We would be representing the individual in their capacity as a union member, not in their full. So it is representation, but it is a limited form of representation. I think to clarify, the contested case hearing process is not just the administrative law judge hearing. That is why we want both the broader definition. An organizer may go through the first few steps, which is an internal process. The one case, we have only had one case that has gone to administrative law judge, at which point it was our staff attorney who was to represent. It's that we don't want to have a lawyer have to necessarily do every single step in the process if that's not necessary. In fact, we've had many, many cases that we've been able to resolve at the beginnings of this process and never needed to go all the way to Mr. Law Judge.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Moyer and I spoke a bit previously. We're unable to fully connect on this. I'm really, as you can tell, sympathetic to the intent, but I believe this approach, this bill, might be potentially perilous and actually detrimental. And I would love the opportunity. Perhaps, I suspect we can work this out. I would love that opportunity.
Well, we don't have to move it today. I'm a patient man. But that being said, you have a worker, unsophisticated, finds themselves in this situation. I think they should have legal representation. When you say we're organizer, look, I've met lots of organizers of varying skills levels. I would be careful with who the organizer is you pick. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Megan, I was wondering, does your union represent people in unemployment hearings?
Mr. Schaffler, Representative Witt, I actually don't know the answer to that.
That's a fair answer. Representative Witt.
Another question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Did you have someone from the union show up at a contested case hearing with a home care worker and they were denied an opportunity to participate in the proceeding?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Witt, yes, that is the precedent for this bill, is that we were told by Department of Justice that they were not able to be present. We did work out a kind of a temporary little fix, which was really not sufficient, but...
Please, Chairman. And was your union given a reason why they couldn't participate in that hearing other than you're not allowed to?
We were told that even though it was in our language of our contract and it was in administrative rule, that the statutes pertaining to a home care worker in an administrative law judge hearing did not only allowed for the individual to have their own private attorney. It did not allow for union representation.
Thank you very much.
Any further questions of Ms. Moyer today?
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Matthews, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My only comment is that several times, and you alluded to this, there's an opportunity to resolve these early in disputes, and it's based on there can be a misinterpretation of the language. That language is often negotiated by these individuals, not lawyers, not attorneys, not paid officials, people that are represented and voted to represent for these people. And so I think, you know, I see what you're asking for as being very reasonable. I don't think you're trying to go out and play attorney for anybody. I think there's a point in time when you call that attorney, and for instance, we use Mike Tedesco. He does a great job for us, but we don't use him on everything. Because quite honestly, a lot of this is about negotiating the contract language and understanding the interpretation of that language. So, you know, I can understand where somebody might have a little bit of angst in this, but I can also say that this makes reasonable sense to me, provided that the reason they didn't allow you in there was because they didn't feel that you had a role in this. And I certainly do understand the role of your organization in terms of representing the employee, because each employee is your organization. And those decisions end up coming back as past practice later on down the road. And if you're not a part in that and negotiating that language and understanding the clarification of why something went wrong on you, then it certainly comes back and affects every member of the organization. So I think you're asking very reasonable here.
Representative Schaffler, members of the committee, I would also like to state that this was a process in which we did have a meeting where Department of Human Services staff was on the phone call, DOJ staff was on the phone call. In the Senate side, Department of Human Services testified in favor of the bill, and DOJ has not opted to testify on this bill. So I would like to add that context, because I think this is something that has actually been discussed. This is not a bill that hasn't been vetted and looked at by others.
And Megan, on that, before I go to Representative Cameron, I believe you. I'm confident we're going to pass this bill. I believe the union does have standing in these subjects. I believe administrative law judges are very considerate and understanding and even helpful to the workers in these situations, because the employer can come with a whole team of sophisticated people and that little worker can come by themselves, and I don't think that's fair or right. That being said, I want to give my friend here the opportunity to get his way to yes on this. I think that's a positive, healthy thing to do as well. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to, from a fairness standpoint, from employers today, I go to Representative Witt's comment about an unemployment hearing. Employers today come to those hearings all the time without attorneys, but with people who are specialized in employment, unemployment law, and understanding that. And this bill just makes sense that, and that would be a representative of that employer not the employer's attorney. This bill makes sense that the employee comes forward and doesn't need a personal attorney but a representative from the union to help them wiggle through something, and it might happen to be an attorney. I don't see what the real cloudy issues are here. Today, with ALJs, we do not necessarily have attorneys in the room, so as people who are qualified to help support on both sides.
Well, we have an attorney in the room today. Therefore, I'm going to just... If you can come to some agreement, great. I believe the votes exist without my friend's vote. That isn't the way I'd like to see it happen. And I think he has everyone's best interest at heart, or he wouldn't be sitting up here with the rest of us. Any further questions? Representative Holby.
Just comment, Mr. Chair. I know it's pretty common that our ALJs are judges and the like, but I think actually there is some historical evidence that not all ALJs are even attorneys. So, I want to make that comment that... the employer can be represented without an attorney and with specialists, and the ALJ himself may be a specialist in administrative hearings, but may not necessarily be an attorney. And so, I'm comfortable with the bill the way it is. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further comments or questions of Ms. Moyer? We'll bring it back very soon, so just get with my friend here and take care of it. Would anyone else like to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 383 today? Seeing no one, I'm going to close the public hearing, and we will have it back very shortly, very soon. And with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 152A.
Mr. Chair, Committee Members, Senate Bill 152A authorizes the Department of Corrections and the Department of Human Services to procure, contract for, or enter into agreements for goods and services necessary for the successful management and maintenance of institutions within their respective jurisdictions. The measure also transfers authority to enter an agreement for information technology from the Director of the Department of Human Administrative Services to the Department of Education for agreements that are related to either student assessment and to other state agencies that are authorized to enter into such agreements for IT under specific provisions of law. There is an emergency clause in the measure, effect upon passage, and the measure passed unanimously out of both the Senate Education, General and Government Committee and the Senate floor.
All right. Before us, I would assume we have Diane Lancaster and Jeremy Emerson. Go ahead, folks.
Thank you, Representative Schaffer. I'm going to let Mr. Emerson go first.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Jeremy Emerson, Interim Chief Administrative Officer for Department of Human Services, here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 152A. This bill was introduced by the Governor on behalf of the Department of Human Services. There is no fiscal impact to DHS. Basically, what we have this bill doing is just completing a full cycle of procurement authority for our institutions within DHS. That's the Oregon State Hospital. We already enjoy a large degree of procurement authority, and this will cover that authority, which we would classify as maintenance, like doing a roof or doing a parking lot, painting, those sorts of things. We already have authority to erect new buildings and enter into contract for millions of dollars of client services contracts. We just want to complete that just for our institutions. As you know, they're 24/7 operations, which requires us to have a staffers that are certified and understand the procurement code. What this bill does not do is actually exempt us from any of the requirements within ORS 279A, B, and C. It does not exempt us from having to complete feasibility studies as required by our collective bargaining agreements. So we basically are just asking that the staff that already know how to do the work for our institutions be afforded the opportunity to do it. Thank you.
Representative Schaffer, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Diane Lancaster from the Department of Administrative Services, the State Procurement Office, and I'm the Chief Procurement Officer there. We're supportive of updating and revising the procurement authority of the Department of Human Services and the Department of Corrections to manage procurements key to their institutional needs. When we got started working with this bill, Department of Justice pointed out that we have a statute in 279 9A, which is in the Public Procurement Code, which is a collection of authorities. It's kind of a handy-dandy guide, if you will, to major state agencies and the procurement authorities that they enjoy. And it helps us all keep things straight. So we started to work on a bit of housekeeping amendment in the Senate side and had some discussions with legislative counsel about that, and frankly, just ran out of time to complete this piece because we ran into just a little bit of issue for the Department of Education, and we wanted to make sure that we did not tamper with anything that they need. So we have a proposed amendment which we would like to have authorized by the committee to be prepared. It's a small housekeeping piece, and with that then we would be prepared to fully support and be able to move this on through into implementation.
Any questions of these good people? Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your joint testimony here. I'm searching for a little bit more context. I've read the staff measure summary. I listened to what you've both said thus far, but I need some clarification about what it is that you can currently contract for and what you cannot contract for.
Take that. Chair Schaffler, Representative Edwards, I appreciate the question. We currently have a number of contracts with, say, doctors, nurses, and we actually are in the process of building a new hospital, and we have the authority to do that. What we're looking for is just to complete total procurement authority just for our institutions, not for all of DHS, just the institution of Oregon State Hospital, to, if we need something, to go actually follow the processes set forth in ORS 279 to procure contract for those goods and services.
Follow up, please.
So you've said a couple times now, complete procurement authority, so you can procure something that's needed. I mean, like, give me some examples. Rolls of tape or...
I'm just
trying to get a sense of what it is we're talking about.
I appreciate the question.
And I want to know the benefits of you doing it relative to DASTA. Why do we need to do this?
Very good. Chair Schaffler, Representative Edwards. An example might be pest control, where it's going to be a significant amount of money, say over $150,000, to handle that the particular request. We would have our procurement staff then have to coordinate with Diane's staff in the State Procurement Office to go and handle a solicitation process and then contract directly with the pest control. Or it could be pick another service, maybe painting one of our outbuildings or putting a new roof on some of our buildings. That's the nature of some of those procurements that we're describing that we want authority for.
Representative Schaffler, Representative Edwards, perhaps I could help also by saying that the department has many of those types of services that are needed, both the Department of Human Services and the Department of Corrections, and they are fairly specialized to the institutional care setting. Frankly, each of those departments is pretty well set up with their procurement folks to do that kind of work. At our office, we believe our highest and best use is to do the larger enterprise state price agreements and to work with things that are more multiple agency focused, so that was why we felt that this was probably a good recognition and update of the statute.
Final clarification. So neither of you feel that this is a major shift in procurement policy. It really is. I mean, would both of you characterize this as kind of housekeeping-ish?
Yeah, Chair Schaffler and Representative Edwards, that's exactly what it is. We're talking a very insignificant amount of procurements. We do hundreds every month in these institutions, and in fact, Diane mentioned they actually put price agreements in place for us, janitorial supplies, those sorts of things. We leverage those price agreements. We will continue to leverage those price agreements. It's those in those events where we don't have under contract some specific item that we need for the institution that might classify as maintenance, that sort of thing. That's the procurement that we're talking about. There's only a few that come up each year.
Thank you.
So it's just instead of DHS and their procurement along with DAS and theirs, just DHS will do it. So are we going to save money to do this?
I'll let Jeremy answer that.
Chair Schaffler, I believe that actually it flattens the process. I believe that it expedites the procurement of those things so we don't have to have a procurement specialist already in the know of what the process is necessary to get a contract in place, then have to actually go over to DAS and have them do it on their behalf.
Do flattening and expediting save money?
Yes, Chair Schaffler, I believe they do.
Thank you very much. Any further questions of these good people? And I think these are examples of things we can put on our new website we're going to have, right?
Yes, Chair Schaffler, absolutely.
Okay, so we can keep an eye on you. All right. Any further questions of these good people? And then we're going to get the amendment, right?
Yes, sir.
All right, very good. Anyone else would like to testify on Senate Bill 152A today? Seeing no one, I'm going to close the public hearing on the bill. Anything for the good of the order? All right.
Adjournment.
We are adjourned.